Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. La Matanza, or the killings of the early 20th century, marked a period of state-sanctioned violence against ethnic Mexicans in Texas. Many fell victim to the Texas Rangers. Even the slightest suspicion of a crime resulted in executions and outright massacres, like the 15 innocent men and boys killed in Porvenir in 1918 in what was suspected to be an act of revenge by the Texas Rangers, Army cavalry soldiers, and local ranchers. Convictions were few and far between in attempting to bring law enforcement to justice. The Porvenir massacre drove Mexican-American lawmaker J.T. Canales to hold hearings into the criminal conduct of the Texas Rangers. Canales was something of a hero to the oppressed families who were looking for justice. 1910 to 1920 is the time period for a fictional Mexican-American superhero who's bringing justice to the Texas-Mexico borderlands. He's known as El Rinche, the Ghost Ranger of the Rio Grande. Rinche is a derogatory term used to describe the Texas Rangers. The character El Rinche in this case is more of a Chicano ninja superhero. His creator joins us on today's show to talk about El Rinche. Dr. Christopher Carmona is a member of Refusing to Forget, a group of historians that shines light on the undertold history of violence against ethnic Mexicans. Carmona says it's a history he learned as a young boy from his grandfather.
And so he would tell me these stories about the, you know, Texas Rangers Rinches when I was a young boy. And I really didn't, you know, at the time, really understand the significance of what he was telling me until much later in my life. And by that time, he was already in his 90s and he had Alzheimer's, so it was kind of hard to recapture that. But the character itself is, the entire book, is really a response to the histories not being in the textbooks and the stories, even though it was a huge part of the history of the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas, as well as the United States. And a lot of people don't know what happened there. It does two different things. One is that it provides the history that I grew up with my grandparents' stories. And it also gives a superhero, a Latino superhero, which we sorely lack in a lot of popular culture at this time. I mean, most people could probably name like two or three Latino superheroes out there, and that's about it, if they can do that. So this was a way to kind of bring this history to a younger audience, to younger generations, obviously through a superhero lens, because there were heroes during this time. This character is based on different types of people. If we go back to the original type of American superhero, which was Joaquin Murrieta, which was a, you know, was a book, but he was a real person in the 1850s in California who became known as this kind of wild bandit or revolutionary, depending on which way you look at it. And in the 1850s, there was a reporter named John Rollingridge who was reporting on his stories. And John Rollingridge himself was a Cherokee Indian. And he wrote the book called The Life and Times of Joaquin Murrieta, which became a huge success and led to really looking at the first type of superhero story. Because from that comes the Zorro comics in the early 20th century. And so the Zorro comics are kind of become about because of the myths and legends behind Joaquin Murrieta. And the other interesting fact is that in the 1930s, I think 30s and 40s, there was two writers who were trying to write for the Zorro comic, and they couldn't get work, so they created their own character, which were, the two guys were Bill Finger and Bob Kane, which became Batman. So the lineage of the hero, the superhero, goes back to a Mexican-American folk hero.
That's a story you don't hear.
No.
So tell us, I mean, every superhero has an origin story. Mm. What's the origin story of the main character for El Rinche?
So the main character is Ascension Ruiz de la Plata, who's the son of a land grant owner. So it ties into the history of land grants in how that played out, the Spanish land grant system and Mexican landowners, and how a lot of that land was being taken, right? Especially in the early 20th century, which where it culminated in the most concentrated violence that occurred. So he's the son of a landowner, is caught up a massacre of his family, but he ends up being left for dead, and he gets picked up by two other characters who then nurse him to health, and they create this kind of hero character, which is this ghost of a Texas Ranger. The two characters break him up. One of them is Bass Reeves. He was the original archetype for the Lone Ranger character. He was an African-American U.S. Marshal who got his commission during Reconstruction. And he became literally the most successful lawman in U.S. history that nobody knows about. And it was basically his life that the Lone Ranger comics are based off of. And so I think there's a show that came out recently on Paramount about Bass Reeves. So he's starting to get some press. But for me, to bring him into this story, which is this kind of anti-Lone Ranger story in a lot of ways, helps me to bring that real history of who he was and how important his story is. So that's kind of where I start tying in a lot of the real history into the stories.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of historians are shining a lot more light now on histories told from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's the perspective, like you say, a lot of people aren't learning. Mm-hmm. We are learning the history that was established by the people who... You know, history's written by the victors, as mm-hmm. the saying goes, and those are the ones who wrote this history. But there were many people whose voices were attempted to be suppressed, and those voices are the ones that are now telling these stories.
Yes. So, I mean, yeah, a lot of that is definitely what's going on with this series. So the series is, this is the third volume that just recently came out in January, and this is a four-volume series, so the fourth one will be the kind of the ultimate... It leads up to one of the major incidents in this whole history, which is the J.T. Canales hearings on the activities of the Texas Rangers. That's where this all kind of leads toward. A lot of the histories that end up in this book, even though it is fictionalized, includes a lot of real stories and real history, historical events that took place. So a lot of the stories I gathered were from descendants. A lot of the research I did was talking with descendants of the families. So my family was affected by the violence during this time. My great-grandfather had to take his family into Mexico in the middle of the Mexican Revolution for 2 years.
Which was dangerous in itself. People were leaving Mexico to flee the violence.
Yeah, they left here because it was way too dangerous.
Wow.
For 2 years, my family was in Mexico. And so that was the loss of lands that we start to talk about. And then, a good friend of mine, who's also a co-founder of Refusing to Forget, Trinidad Gonzalez, his grandfather was murdered by the Texas Rangers. You know, there's a lot of stories when you start to talk to a lot of descendants about what they were doing down there. And these stories are, like I said, were not in the books, right? But they are the stories of the people down there, and South Texas for sure.
Going back to J.T. Canales, yes. The Latino legislator who started these investigations, I mean, he was an outlier himself,
yes.
In his time. And from what I understand, all of the testimonies and all of the investigations, they lay buried in an archive. And nobody, unless you were there or read those news reports that you were talking about, they were left undiscovered until they were by accident by a scholar at UT Austin, right?
James Sandoz, yes.
Yeah.
So the actual transcripts of the hearings were basically buried for almost, I believe when James Sandoz found it was in the 90s. And he wasn't supposed to get a copy of it. The clerk didn't realize that she wasn't supposed to give it to him. It was actually in 2015 when the archives finally digitized them and released them. And so up until that point, they were pretty much kept under wraps as to what happened during that time. So doing research was hindered up until that because we never really had, I guess, firsthand accounts of people who were testifying. But yeah, the J.T. Canales hearings are now publicly available anywhere. You can kind of look them up and download like all 3,000 pages. They had over like, I think, 200 people testify against the activities of what they were doing. And those testimonies are powerful because they're coming from all over. I mean, most of the bulk of that is coming from South Texas, which makes Fort Vernier interesting because that happened out in West Texas. But the bulk of the violence took place in South Texas. And a lot of what was happening was a land grab move to take lands from the basically the last holders of these ranches out there. Yeah, I mean, when we look at the J.T. Canales hearings and why they were kept under wraps, I remember with James Santos had found a note that says, do not distribute. One major thing is that because they would be susceptible to civil rights violations because of all of the that was coming out in those testimonies were civil rights violations, and that would be a federal case. If we're looking at the early 1920s, that's a very different world. And that would have been much different because around this time we also have the up-and-coming, what they call the rise of the New South. The KKK is gaining power. So this would have been a major blow to a lot of that, to their power coming up at that time.
Christopher Carmona is the author of the El Rinche Young Adult series of books. The third book in the four-part series is called El Rinche Matanza. Carmona is the director of the Center for Mexican American Studies and Research at Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio and a member of Refusing to Forget, a project that seeks to educate about the state-sanctioned violence against ethnic Mexicans in the early 20th century. When we come back, the character of El Rinche is described as a Chicano ninja, and there's a historical reason for that.
During this time, a lot of people don't know that the Japanese were in South Texas. They were in the Rio Grande Valley.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Ascensión Ruiz de la Plata is an unlikely hero. He's the green-eyed Mexican-American son of a landowner in South Texas whose family is massacred in an act of state-sanctioned violence in the early 20th century. He assumes the identity of El Rinche Fantasma, the Ghost Ranger, to seek justice. El Rinche appears as a masked figure in black, donning a white cowboy hat, two machetes, and a bandolier emblazoned with throwing stars. His companions are the real-life black lawman Bass Reeves and a Japanese samurai named Hiro. El Rinche is the main character in a YA series of the same name. The third installment of the series, El Rinche Matanza, was released in January 2025. Its author, Christopher Carmona, explains the historical background as to why El Rinche is described as a Chicano ninja.
Yeah, the character itself, the reason he looks the way he does is because his other mentor, the other half of this, is a Japanese, basically an ex-ninja. And so he basically gets, you know, ninja powers because during this time, a lot of people don't know that the Japanese were in South Texas. They were in the Rio Grande Valley. There was two major colonies down there. One was basically now South Padre Island, Port Isabel, and the other one was above Mission. And these Japanese colonies were integrated into the communities. During the Mexican Revolution, they did train the Mexican soldiers in martial arts. They worked in munitions. And so there were actually a lot of Japanese influence, which did allow me to bring in this kind of characteristics for this character. That's why he looks like that.
Are there still a lot of Japanese descendants of those residents still there in South Texas?
Well, not as much. What happens is during the Matanza, the Mexican peoples were not the only ones targeted. The Japanese were also targeted as well. So a lot of them fled into Mexico. I did interview a few descendants. So what ends up happening is they would go into Mexico and they would change their names from like Ichura to Ozuna. And so they would blend into the Mexican populations. And one of the people I interviewed was the granddaughter of one of these Japanese. So her family is now a Mexican name, but their grandfather was actually Japanese. So they did a lot of that too because of the violence that was attributed during this time that they were forced out as well. They owned those lands that they had. There's a whole story there. There's even a few books about, you know, Asian peoples. And even here in San Antonio, there's a presence that still exists here. It's kind of like how we start to look at history is like, well, there's only Mexicans in South Texas. There never was. There was always a mixture of people.
We'll swing back to La Matanza. I know this is one of the main reasons why the group Refusing to Forget was created. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the group and how it has been marking the 110th anniversary of the Matanza?
So the Matanza, the specifically 1915 is considered the bloodiest year of the entire time frame. And that's really where they get the term Matanza comes from, is from that year. It was really the most concentrated violence summer. And then we're looking at hundreds of Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals that were murdered during this time, lynched and murdered. And during this time was really a lot of things that were happening politically. So what we've been doing with Refusing to Forget is trying to raise awareness of what's going on. So one of the major things we have going on is the traveling exhibit, The Life and Death on the Border, which started at the Bob Bullock Museum and right now is at the Houston Holocaust Museum. So back in January, we had a opening reception where we talked about the Matanza. And right now it is, you can see it there. So, I mean, even being included as an exhibit within the Holocaust Museum is an honor because that's one of the things that we can show is, you know, these genocides occur all over, and especially when we're looking at this time frame. But the work we do to raise awareness, the traveling exhibit, you know, the publishing of these books that we have coming out. Ben Johnson also has a book that just came out as well, who's also a member, kind of retelling the history of Texas in a very, very different way.
Well, and again, it's a part of history that I'm going to say until recently was maybe in the last decade or so was not really told. But now you're seeing a lot more documentaries, say, on PBS, especially in areas like Porvenir, where there was a massacre and a battle over a historical marker, which was eventually resolved. But again, these are instances of history that are starting to bubble up, you know, a century after they occurred.
So Porvenir is really the inciting incident that leads to the opening of the J.T. Canales hearings because it made national news. I mean, a lot of the massacres and lynchings that were occurring did not make the news, but because of the kind of circumstances and who witnessed the Porvenir massacre, that it actually was able to make the news, which forced the state of Texas to have hearings. One of the things we did not expect, there's a show on, I think it's Fox, called 911 Lone Star, which stars Rob Lowe. I believe it was last season where there's two characters, and one of them, they're two Mexican-American characters, and one of them is, the father is a Texas Ranger and the son is a police officer. And in the scene, the father is trying to convince the son to become a Texas Ranger. And the son's argument says that he won't because of Porvenir. And when we heard that, it's like, this is on national TV.
Wow.
One of our members reached out to try to figure out, you know, where they got this information. And so one of the screenwriters for that episode was from San Antonio. And so he knew of the work that we were doing, so he decided to put that into the show. So that kind of when we're reaching that kind of a medium, says that we're getting some traction out there.
The resurgence in pop culture, so to speak. I mean, are you seeing, there are young people taking these classes. They're not taught about much of this in schools. And, you know, Mexican-American studies may or may not survive the upcoming years in public schools. There are a lot of very well-informed young people nowadays. Yes. Have you seen sort of that shift in knowledge base amongst the students that you teach?
So, yes. I mean, I think when we look at the different, especially the younger people, you know, their access to information is way different than it was when we were children, right? We didn't have the internet. But a lot of the way that the younger people are getting their information is from social media, TikTok and these different things. And And because of TikTok and things like that, there's a lot of podcasts that go through the histories. These are kind of untold histories that are out there. And students are more, you know, aware of those. And, you know, whoever thought that podcasts would be such a huge success? It's a radio show, basically.
Right.
But they are extremely popular amongst young people, which is saying something that we're kind of going back to the 1930s where everything was radio shows.
So I'm wondering if, well, we have a new administration now that's cracking down on anything that has to do with diversity. Mm-hmm. You're seeing so many universities start to scale back a lot of their programs, African-American mm-hmm. studies, Mexican-American studies, LGBTQ studies. Mm-hmm. I know you work at Our Lady of the Lake, which is not publicly funded. It's a private university. Mm-hmm. But is that eventually going to reach the halls of Our Lady of the Lake because you might receive federal funds for grants, say?
Well, so it's not nearly as much as people think, because we are kind of going the other way. We're kind of doubling down. The mission statement for the university has social justice written into it. So our ultimate, you know, authority is the Sisters of Divine Providence. And they are very much about social justice. Though, you know, the Center for Mexican-American Studies has been there since the early 70s, right? And it is an integral part of the identity of the university. But because we are a private institution, we are shielded from certainly Texas law. But no, I think that that is one of the main identities of the campus, of the university. And as far as I know, we're sticking with that. I mean, I don't see why we wouldn't. And, you know, I've had, there's a lot of students who I've had that I've taught that really enjoy the fact that we are able to do that. And I've been talking to students from the Alamo colleges who want to talk to me about going to Our Lady of the Lake because they're afraid that public institutions won't be able to get this kind of history there. And so they want to go to a place where they can. So I think that, you know, when we think about what's going on politically, I think when we look at education, the ones that actually have the most power are the students. And if the students want something, they're ultimately, you know, at any university, who you're supposed to serve first, right? So with the students really wanting to have this information, wanting to have this history, wanting to have this knowledge, that is a power that that administration can't ever really touch.
Well, going back to another project that Refusing to Forget had, I think in the last couple of years, marking the, I believe, 200th anniversary of the founding of the yes. Texas Rangers. I know there was a call to try to get the Rangers to acknowledge their history and perhaps mm-hmm. even apologize for some of the violence that they committed. I know they say that we're not the Texas Rangers mm-hmm. of back then. We're a different kind of Texas Rangers now. But did you ever make any grounds in trying to get them to see to some of the demands you had been asking?
So not directly from the actual, you know, Commission on the Bicentennial of Texas Rangers. It was run from the Texas Ranger Heritage Museum out of Waco, right? But we had other types of victories that were unforeseen. So about almost 2 years ago now, the little town of San Diego, Texas, they actually had a ceremony because the county judge wrote a proclamation stating that the Texas Rangers murdered basically these three men. That became a major sore point for the community. So there was a corrido written almost after these three men were murdered. Cordillo de Oliveira, which was one of the main men that were killed. So these three Mexican men were killed while they're going to a wedding in Mexico. I think there was five in the party. And one of the three men that were murdered was going to be the groom. The Texas Rangers had ambushed them. And of course, the report they wrote is that they were smuggling. And they always use the term smuggling or bandit. What makes that report, you know, so strikingly a lie is that they were going to Mexico, not coming from Mexico. So it didn't make a lot of sense. But the community there, the county judge, wrote a proclamation 2 years ago stating that the Texas Rangers murdered these three men, which is the first county in Texas ever to acknowledge that.
Wow.
And so when I went to that ceremony and the proclamation was given to the three granddaughters who were all in their 80s, and there was over 300 people that attended that because they're all family members of these three men that were murdered. And you see this kind of healing that happening because they finally get recognition that their, you know, their grandparents, their ancestors were not criminals. What we do the work for mostly is for the healing of these communities. Looking at what happened in Port Vanier, I've been working with descendants from there, descendants from, you know, live here in San Antonio, descendants from the Valley. And a lot of them just want justice. They want just an acknowledgement that this is what happened to them. And that in itself is, you know, what we've been able to really achieve from the community. So I don't think the commission's ever going to admit to any of these. But, you know, we're not doing it for their approval. We really want the descendants to really have their say, right?
Dr. Christopher Carmona is the director of the Center for Mexican American Studies and Research at Our Lady of the Lake University in San Antonio and a member of Refusing to Forget, a project that seeks to educate about the state-sanctioned violence of Mexican Americans in the early 20th century. He's the author of the YA series El Rinche. The latest installment, El Rinche Matanza, is out now. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marianne Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.